Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another season of Spinning the Reel. I'm your host, Evan.
And I'm your host, Zach.
Season five, Zach?
Is
Season
it?
two for
Yeah,
you, right?
I guess it is season five.
Pat ourselves on the back. As you guys might notice, we are starting the season sort of the way we ended it last. No Cody to start the year. He is still busy with work projects, but he does hope to be on the show pretty regularly. I don't know. We're going to find out. Just as we're going to try and put this out pretty regularly this season as well, get back to our old ways. And in that spirit, Zach, what are we talking about today?
Today we are talking about the number one hit movie, of course, Megan.
Yes, Slay.
And then a late release from last year, Puss in Boots, The Last Wish. And in the middle, we're going to be talking about 2023 Sundance. We have a online pass, but just like last year, so we're going to talk about some of the movies we're going to watch and discuss in future episodes.
Yeah, it sounds exciting. Yeah, with that, I guess we should point out the date. So when Cody listens to this, he knows when it was. We are recording this on Tuesday, January 17th. And yeah, with that, let's dive right in.
Ever since I was little, I dreamed of this perfect toy that would protect a kid from ever feeling lonely or sad. This is Megan.
Hi, Megan. I'm Katie. It's nice to meet
you. All right, Zach, we are starting off with, like you said, the number one movie in America. Maybe, I'm not clear on that. It might still be Avatar.
I was joking, but it's entirely possible because it's been, you know, it's January. It's a light month.
Right. And that is Megan. Basically like a Chucky redux kind of thing about a girl whose parents die. And her aunt is taking care of her, but her aunt's like a, you know, renowned toy designer. And she kind of doesn't really have time to watch after her orphan niece. So she builds this doll. I guess she was kind of working on it already, but for the sake of this, she builds this doll to basically spend time with the girl and entertain her, watch after her, this sort of thing. The doll is called Megan. Do you remember what Megan stands for?
It's Zach? Like, oh man, it's something three algorithm. I don't remember.
I don't either. But anyway, it is a horror movie of sorts. Things go a little haywire as the doll begins to take its, I don't know, its mission to protect this girl whose name I also can't remember. Do you know that one? No.
The girl's name, the central.
Yeah, what's the main girl's name? Katie. Katie.
That's right.
So as she takes her mission to protect Katie maybe a little bit more seriously than she should, she also sort of gains artificial intelligence, some sentience, and she begins to wreak havoc on the people around that may be threatening Katie. What did you think of Megan, Zach?
I thought it was just like a lot of fun, like really kind of really silly, not the best movie, but just I would be lying if I said I didn't have a good time in theater watching this one.
Yeah, I did too. You know, I think you sort of, I don't know, kind of recommended it to myself and Anna, and we were a little hesitant, I think, because horror isn't really our genre. Most of the time, you know, we're not the people that are, you know, going to be first in line to go see Skinamarink or anything like that. But when you said it wasn't really that scary, it was more of like a funny kind of thing. We went for it. And man, what a time. What a blast. It's such a ridiculous, campy movie. And
yeah,
I had a good
is.
Time with it, too.
And I think that even though like the marketing around this has been pretty like social media, you know, moment sort of centric, I think it, even the trailer undersells just how goofy this movie is.
Mm-hmm.
It's just really silly. Every trope of like, you know, a living doll is present here, and to great effect. Especially like you know, I guess like the famous clip of is of her doing that like TikTok dance before she murders
which
that
is
guy. And
then, one scene, yeah, she doesn't ever do it again.
And then the completely unnecessarily, by the way, like she's just having a good time becoming a murderous sentient robot. And then like when she like bear crawls in the woods,
yes, when she rips the guy's ear off and it gets all stretchy,
yeah.
I think the best one, maybe like the most iconic moment that people seem to keep coming back to is it's like the, I think after Katie sort of realizes that she's been killing these people, she like sits by her bedside and sings Titanium by Sia. And it's just like the most ridiculous thing you'll see in a movie.
Yeah, I think when I saw this, trying to remember, I don't remember. It was like a later showing. It was like a nighttime showing, maybe like 8 p.m. or something. But the theater was pretty full. And yeah, just uproarious like laughter at that moment, because that's just not what you expect at all. This is very like grim realization for Katie that that Megan has been hurting people. And then she just starts singing Titanium completely straight face, like no, I don't know.
Yeah, and it's just this, the whole thing is so goofy. I think that's maybe the best way to describe it. Like, you know, there's different parts where the doll is talking back to what is her aunt's name, Gemma, and she'll tell it to stop, and she's like, "We're past that now, Gemma," and things like that. And then randomly she just has like a remote control for Megan later. Like just a lot of little inconsistencies and stuff that kind of, I think, just add into what makes this movie so fun is that it's not taking itself seriously as like, you know, there are a lot of things in this that probably aren't technologically accurate to any sort of degree or anything like that, but it doesn't really matter. And it's not really even scary to any extent either. It's just, what can we do here that is the most like over the top ridiculous thing? Can we have this doll murder like three people and then walk down the stairs, get in a car and drive it away? Like, yes, we can do that. That is something that we are capable of as filmmakers.
Yeah. What a blast. I did. That was one thing that like right off the bat, I kind of had me rolling my eyes though. I mean, you say that it really doesn't matter, like the actual like science behind it, but sort of like the philosophy of artificial intelligence, the most basic question that we ask ourselves is like, how do we confront the alignment problem? Where it's this movie, right? If you give an AI an instruction that's too broad, eventually it may value that initial instruction more than what, you know, it contradictory to our own human values.
Sure.
And that's exactly what happens here. I think very early on, Gemma like impulsively tells Megan to not let anyone hurt Katie. And I think it's more just like, I don't remember the exact line, but it's more than just prevent harm. It's like shield her from any possible harm, you know, physical, emotional, or otherwise. And then of course, she uses that to justify later hurting people around her and like even controlling Katie to a sense and influencing her and turning her against like her aunt. And then just like a pretty satisfying end, I think, when I think the other robot's name is like Bruce or something that comes back.
Which, you know, as soon as they introduce him at the very beginning of the movie, you know that's where it's going. Like, yeah, this is not a movie that
Chekhov's
is subtle.
Robot, like,
yeah. It's certainly one of those
things.
That's
such a classic like technology horror film trope too, is the analog where like the older technology will save us, like iRobot or something, and then like, you know, this one is just this robot that still needs human interface to control. Really funny though, just I think if you can get to a theater to see this one, you should. It's in, or when it comes to streaming later, it's a fun one.
Yeah, it's going to be just as fine at home. I think where this movie fails, and again, it's hard to even say, obviously this movie isn't a good movie per se. Like, it's, as far as a piece of quality filmmaking, you know, some of the better horror movies would use like Katie's loss and maybe remorse or guilt or whatever emotion you want to attach to, you know, being in that car with her parents as they die, and turn it into something like some sort of meditation on that grief or guilt or whatever. But this movie isn't really interested in that. Like, Megan is definitely the main character in this movie, and really kind of squaring off against her creator, Gemma, played by Allison Williams, who is kind of becoming the central figure of a lot of horror movies these days, it seems like. But it's not really the most effective use of Katie as a character, but that doesn't mean it's not fun. And, like, you know, the whole point is to, you know, have Megan bouncing around doing these things. So I didn't really have too much of a problem with it, even though, like, on a technical level, it's got issues.
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, no shade to, like, the creators, I guess. It doesn't feel like something that was meant to be super, like, philosophical or analytical of, mm-hmm. you know, the dangers of AI or what AI is replacing. Because really what you have is a child who loses both her parents, who's orphaned at the beginning, and then you have an aunt that has no idea what to do with children. So she turns to what she does know, which is technology, and uses that to sort of replace herself as a parental figure in her niece's life when her niece really needs her more than ever.
Mm-hmm.
And so that sort of, like, is explored in, like, the surface level, right? And you
have the psychiatrist kind of bringing it up, like,
yeah, exactly.
In passing.
I forgot about that psychiatrist character.
Yeah.
And then you also have, like, the, you know, the standard boilerplate, like, anti-capitalism, where the toy company, this guy Ronnie Chang, doing an awful job out here, but
hey, he just wants to make those
doesn't
profits.
Care yeah doesn't care about the consequences of this toy, you know, that he just wants to get it to market as quick as possible without really it's like a Jurassic Park kind of thing, you know,
and actually kind of marketing it as you don't have to watch after your own kid.
How grim is that, right?
Yeah he's pretty ridiculous, and it kind of ends, his arc sort of ends in the predictable place for a movie like this. But I think it doesn't do justice to, I think, pretty much any of the characters except for Megan herself. Like, hers is the only character that gets any sort of exploration about, you know, why they're doing what they're doing or how they're reacting, and, like, kind of seeing the evolution of the doll more so than any of the characters themselves. I think when the girl's name is Violet McGraw, the girl that plays Katie, gets a chance to kind of do her thing towards the end, is when she gets separated from Megan and like is supposed to be displaying this bond with Megan and withdrawal from her being away. She kind of gets a little violent herself, and I think it was a good sort of performance in that regards, but she is kind of sidelined for most of the movie, which takes away from Gemma's storyline, and it just all feels a little loose around the edges. But again, it's just filled in, all the gaps are just filled in with ridiculous stunts and songs and set pieces that make it more more entertaining to watch.
Yeah, where the screenplayer, you know, the script is bare bones, it's filled in with moments that are just, like, intentionally or unintentionally hilarious.
Right.
I think too, I think it's fine for the most part. It's not necessarily shooting for the stars, and where it lands is completely serviceable. I think it's a great little dollhouse horror kind of thing, and just.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about the idea of Megan too? You know, the end there, she takes over the AI or whatever. Probably, I mean, this movie's made a bunch of money, so
I swear I heard that they had already greenlighted a sequel even before, like, the wide release date. I don't know. I feel like with these, It's really hard to recapture that lightning in a bottle,
right?
That is Megan.
It's a very specific tone this movie is striking.
Yeah, and I think I think history has shown that attempts to repeat that kind of like to manufacture that kind of success never really works out well. Or if it becomes like it's going to fall victim to like this franchise era that we're in, where every subsequent entry, no matter how shitty it is, they're just going to churn out another one.
Right. I could see the way they could do it. And it probably ends up in the Jurassic Park kind of framework too, where, you know, Allison Williams is the creator that sort of balks at the idea of doing this again, and, you know, some toy executive deciding that it's worth it. But I guess
no, Allison Williams' character should be in jail. She should.
Absolutely.
The next one, like, you know, like that's another trope too in sequels, right? Like someone from the first movie, they have to go visit them to like get the answers or something.
Yeah,
she should be incarcerated. Like, absolutely.
She did create a murder robot.
The whole engineering team, the executives at the company, I mean, one of them was executed by Megan, but
yes,
they should all, absolutely be in jail.
Yes, that is a good point. Do you have any other Megan thoughts? Like, I feel like this isn't the deepest movie to kind of dig into to details or anything, but do you have any other moments or thoughts from this one?
Yeah, I think it is hard to talk about like at length without going over necessarily every plot detail. I think it's greater than the sum of its parts, even if that's still not, you know, the best movie. I think it's a rare gem for a January release. I feel lucky that we got this one set as a way to start off the year, like a pleasant surprise. Would definitely recommend it to anyone who's horror averse like you, or because it's more of like a horror comedy in my opinion.
It's much more campy than it is scary. Mm-hmm. Jamie Lee Curtis said that Megan is the scream queen of 2023, so who's here to argue with her?
I'm sure Jenna Ortega will reclaim that title
by year's end. Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, as is tradition, why don't we do the Letterboxd roundup? Would you like to do the song?
The song? Bulletproof.
That should be our new roundup song.
Far away. Letterboxd,
what did you give Megan?
Roundup. 3 stars straight down the middle. Megan's
I agree. Supremacy. 3 stars with a like thrown on there, because this movie was fun as hell. I'm bulletproof, nothing to lose. Far away, ricochet, you take your aim. Far away. All right, Zach, you mentioned it off the top. We are attending Sundance sort of in earnest this year, still from home, but I guess to a greater degree than we did last year, when I think we only saw a couple movies. But this year we have the online explorer pass, whatever it is. We have I think 10 reservations. Is there anything, I mean, I can rattle them off if you want to hear sort of what we have right
now. Yeah, why don't
we
just start there and let everyone know what 10 reservations we have. I think there's a couple that are unnamed, right? They're like award winner.
Right. Yeah, that's 3 of them, I think. So the 7 that I have us booked for right as of right now is a movie called Sometimes I Think About Dying, Shortcomings, which I think is the Randall Park directorial debut. Sometimes I Think About Dying is, what's her name from Star Wars? Daisy Ridley.
Mm-hmm.
Cat Person, which is the girl from Coda. I don't know, it's a book. Looked interesting. I've got a book from Mama Cruz right now, which is about, I think, an old woman who discovers internet porn. It just sounded funny to me. A movie called Bad Behavior, which is, who's in that one again?
Bad Behavior.
The woman from The Night House.
Is that Rebecca Hall?
Rebecca Hall, I think, is in that one. And then Magazine Dreams is Jonathan Majors. And then the last one, right now I have us booked for Theater Camp, which has Ben Platt, but I think it's Emily Gordon's directorial debut. So that to me sounded pretty interesting. What do you think about that list? Anything in there you're excited about?
Definitely. Sometimes I think about Dying, and I think Shortcomings is the Randall Park one, right?
Yep, I think so.
Those are two that I would say I'm looking forward to the most. I would say I'm curious to see, because so the online pass, right, works slightly different from just attending the festival.
Correct.
There are some, like, all of the world premieres are off limits in terms of making reservations. We just have like
more dramatic
competition, and
we did get one premiere. There was one premiere that was available, and that was Cat Person. Mm-hmm. But the rest of them, like, I think there was a Thomas and Mackenzie movie with Anne Hathaway called Eileen that we weren't able to access. I think there was what else? God,
Jamal Jaya was one that I wanted to watch too. That's the from the director of Blue Bayou, starring.
Okay, yeah, I think that might not have been available, but I can double check again. There's a new Corey Finley movie that wasn't available to us, so it's. I think it has to do with just sort of like release schedules and release.
Right. We also missed out on You Hurt My Feelings, right? Which is the Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Yeah, that one was not available for sure.
But if any of those take home an award,
hopefully we can see them.
Yes, because that's how the pass works. We do have access to the award winner, so you know, if any of those take home, we have reservations for some of the awards already.
Right. So I guess to make the, I guess, logical jump from here is that this is going to be, I think next week or the week after when we get around to these screenings, we have about a week to watch them. We're going to be doing maybe some reviews out of Sundance and see what we have to look forward to for the rest of the year. But yeah, like I said, Mama Cruz looks interesting. I think that's very funny. I'm interested in Magazine Dreams. I think Jonathan Majors, I don't know that I've ever seen him put in a bad performance, or at least one that's not interesting. So I'm kind of interested to see. I read an interview he did.
That man is a force of acting, dude.
He is. He did an interview, and he said that he, you know, had to get in shape for Creed 3, and he basically got, like, ripped for Creed 3, and then he was doing this movie Magazine Dreams, and it's like a different kind of fitness he had to do for this to kind of, because I guess it's a movie more about sort of someone who's pushing themselves to those limits to punish themselves, and it's sort of like a more grotesque kind of thing in that sense. So he was just sort of just even listening to him talk about the differences between like the way he prepares for that versus Creed versus like Ant-Man as Kang the Conqueror. It's going to be a big year for him, and it seems like he's ready to bring it. So
yeah, absolutely. Magazine Dreams does look one of the best ones. And like I said, like Jonathan Majors just incapable of disappointing. I feel like he's got such a distinct like style.
Yeah, and just one of those actors that has such a commanding presence.
Right. Yeah. Some actors you feel like it's like you're not necessarily watching their character. You're like watching the actor.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of both, where every role I've seen him in is like distinctly Jonathan Majors. But I believe that's a character too. He's just an impressive talent.
Yeah. So that one's one that was on my radar for that reason. You mentioned Sometimes I Think About Dying. It looks interesting too. I said Daisy Ridley is the actress there. Description is her character likes to think about dying, brings sensation to her quiet life, and then when she meets a new guy at work, the only thing standing in the way is herself. And so I think that's going to be, I don't know, interesting to see what direction they take that in.
Theater Camp too, I think, is one that is interesting. If only because we get to find out what happened to Evan Hansen, but
He was doing this as he was in high school, actually.
Molly Gordon, as far as her, what I've seen her in is good. Like, I really like her in Rami. She's great in Booksmart. I wonder what her directorial style is going to be like,
and what she's going to be like in like a lead performance too. Because I feel like everywhere that I've seen,
she's also in Shiva Baby. Now that I think about it,
no, that's true.
I love Shiva Baby.
I know, but yeah, I think, you know, her in Booksmart and in I think she's in Good Boys too. It's just sort of like a limited comedic punch, and Rami, she's sort of a more limited presence in that as well. But I'm interested to see what she can do as kind of being the force behind the movie as well. So
you haven't seen season three yet of Rami, have you?
Not yet. Does she have a bigger role?
No, not a bigger role, but she does come back for one episode, and even though it's just one episode, I think
makes an impact.
She's really good in that one.
You know, the best thing we can say about Theater Camp is that Patty Harrison's in it, so
there we go.
That's got to be good, right? So yeah, I mean, I think as much fun as it would be to actually attend in person a Sundance one of these days, I think the fact that they give access online like they do is great for access to these films too. Like, you don't have to be able to afford to fly out to Utah and book a hotel, take a week off of work or whatever, to see some of these new movies. Like, I think the word of mouth and the like broader spread that films are going to get from a release like this, that's going to have sort of both prongs of it, is going to be great. And I think it's something that the pandemic sort of opened up. So maybe like an unintended good consequence of these things, but I'm excited to be able to see these movies again.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is really nice. Definitely good for us not having to make the trip out and still get to see some of these releases that, you know, just even getting into this festival is an achievement in itself.
Mm-hmm.
Worth watching just about anything, even if it was just like, here's 10 movies and you don't get to pick, I would still be interested in this experience.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point too, because I think the thing to note about this is like, a couple years ago, Coda got Best Picture after premiering at Sundance earlier in that year. And I remember seeing Coda as part of like the at-home Sundance, and it was very cool, but I don't know that I thought anything of it seeing it. Like, it really seemed to me like, okay, this is going to be like a family friendly summer release kind of thing, and people are going to like it, but that's about it. And that is usually sort of the reach of Sundance movies. They end up in theaters either a few days from when they premiere, or like a few months, or sometimes even a year or something like that later. But they don't always get the big studio release. They are more independent cinema. And I think that the like individual intense attention that they get from a festival like this gives, like you said, these are talented filmmakers. These are good films that get selected to play at a festival like this. And giving them the attention that they deserve is always a good thing, even if, you know, they're not going to really see the light of day to the extent that maybe they should later on.
Yeah, I think you know, any increase in accessibility to these stories that that people have dedicated their, you know, their time and their craft to, absolutely a net positive, and exposure to cinema is only a good thing in my book.
Well, by the time people next hear us, we will be attending Sundance virtually. So keep your ears open, your podcast feeds reloaded for Sundance reviews, I guess.
Yeah. Follow us on Letterboxd. Big Letterboxd weekend.
Big Letterboxd weekend. That's right.
I am Puss in Boots. Holy frijoles. Hey, Giant! You want to see something cool? Gracias,
The legend will never die.
All right, so we're going to close things out with a movie that's been out a little bit longer than Megan, at least. And that is Puss in Boots, The Last Wish. So I think I'll let you describe what this movie is first, I guess, Zach.
I wouldn't even do a plot description of Megan now that I think about it.
I kind of described what it was at the beginning without explicitly saying that it was a plot description.
We didn't do the subtitle, though. All right, yeah, Puss in Boots, The Last Wish, plot description. This is a story about, Puss in Boots from the Shrek franchise. He got a spinoff after Shrek 2 because he's such
Which was like 10 years ago.
Yeah, right? No, Shrek 2 is like much longer.
No, Puss in Boots, the movie was like,
oh, yeah,
ago,
the original.
It?
Yeah, yeah. So he got his own spinoff. This is in that series. We meet an older puss. I guess he's on his last life. We're introduced to his character in the eighth life, and then he has this big grand battle with like a giant, which he then perishes in, and is told that, you know, this is his last life. And in the course of his nine lives, he has been, this sort of swashbuckling adventurer with kind of rather carefree and reckless and impulsive. But now that he's on his last life, he is afraid for the first time. He chooses to go into retirement until Goldilocks comes to where he's comes to his retirement home, essentially, and he hears about a potential way to regain all of his lives, which is, of course, a very attractive proposition to him, which would return him to his legend status. And then he goes on this journey to secure this last wish.
Yes, I think that's a good description of it. I think I'll add some context around the movie. Is like you brought up, it is a, you know, sequel to a movie 10 years ago that was itself a spinoff of the second movie in another franchise. This is really the branches of DreamWorks, the tips of them here. And, I think we can get into it later. It doesn't seem like it's going to be the last of them. But that's a good way to describe the movie. I think given all that context, I don't know about you, I was a little bit wary about going to see this movie. It seemed unnecessary. It seemed like it was just going to be sort of like trying to cash in on both a franchise and some nostalgia that people might have. And then like the reviews start pouring in and people really like this movie. And I know you really like this movie too. So why don't you start off with like, what makes this movie good?
Well, just to preface this, I was in the exact same boat, right? I remember seeing the trailer for this towards the end of last year, because this released in December, like right before Christmas or right around Christmas time. Yeah, I remember seeing the trailers, going to watch some other prestige film, I'm sure. And yeah, I was like completely blew it off. I was like, I probably won't even go into theaters to watch it because I just don't, I'm not interested. And then, like you said, there was such a genuine and like positive critical and audience response to this. So that piqued my interest. And then a friend of mine was like, hey, I'm going to go watch it. Do you want to come? And I was like, yeah, sure, I'll go. And then I had a blast in theater. It's such a fun movie. And also like good as like children's storytelling goes, especially in the realm of like fairy tales, right? When we think of fairy tales, I think most millennials think of Disney versions of these fairy tales because that's what we grew up with. And our parents gave us those stories because that's what they grew up with. And at least this version, I mean, even Shrek, when it first came out, kind of took those fairy tales and gave us other versions of them. But particularly in this one, reframes three, I guess one is a nursery rhyme. We have Jack Horner, and then we have Puss in Boots, and then we have Goldilocks and the Three Bears. Even Jiminy Cricket's thrown in there. Not that he has like an arc or anything, but And of course, you know, talking to you about this off air, and when I was like, hey, you should go watch this too. The biggest thing and best thing about this movie for me is the manifestation of death, who's represented here by a wolf who's hunting Puss in Boots. And I think death is such an interesting subject on its own, but especially when you approach it from the angle of how do you explain death to a child? And historically, that's what fairy tales have been there for, right? To explain these huge concepts about what it means to be like human or to be alive, or how you should approach your own life and how you should approach other people and your dealings with them in life. That's what fairy tales have always been. And this framing of Puss in Boots' relationship to death and how he spent his 8 lives and how he should spend his last one is such a good lesson. And I think, you know, for most kids who watch this, it will probably go over their head unless their parents have a separate conversation with them after. But it is certainly doing something to explain like how death is sort of not good or bad. It just is. And why death is what actually gives life meaning. It's not something to necessarily be afraid of. You get one shot at this and you should try to make the most of it.
Yeah, I will point out that I have on good authority that the voice actor that plays Death is Brazilian, and apparently
it's I don't remember his name, but it's the same actor who played Pablo Escobar in Narcos.
Oh shoot, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah, which is so funny because I immediately looked it up after the movie because I didn't recognize his name on the screen, and then of course my friend who I went to go watch this with is a huge Narcos fan, so yeah. I told him that, and he's like, oh, that's pretty cool. We were just thinking about how the same guy who's like in that meme of him sitting alone
right.
by himself on the swing is like the voice of this wolf who is an incredible character. I love this version of Death so much.
God, yeah. I am also told that he does not voice the Portuguese version of Death in the Portuguese version of this movie. So I think that's kind of interesting. I don't know. I feel like I would expect that. But not that that's what's important about this movie. You know, I thought it was fine. I thought this movie looked interesting. It's sort of borrowing from the Into the Spider-Verse playbook of making the action sort of almost comic booky in a way.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I agree with that.
Visually inventive. I should note that the way we went to see this movie. So we go to the first showtime yesterday, Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and it's like a 2 o'clock showtime or something. And
probably packed, right?
Never seen a theater more packed. And I was a little surprised. I mean, not shocked, because obviously it's
not
a kid's
even
movie
for Top Gun, man.
On a day off school, right? Even honestly, even more than Top Gun. And so we show up there. It's packed. Kind of makes some amount of sense. It's a smaller theater too. So the only seats left when we're booking are the front two rows. There are 6 seats right in the middle in the second to the front row B or whatever. Couple right in front of us takes the 2 seats right in the middle of that row. So we're like, well, damn. So we take the seats. We watch this movie from the front row.
Nice.
It was excruciating to be that close to a film. And, you know, kids in the back of the theater just kind of like screaming from the very get-go when they do that new DreamWorks intro that they have. Mm-hmm. Shrek shows them. They're like, Shrek, is that Shrek? Why is Shrek in this movie? Like, all right, so we knew we were in for a ride, but they seemed to enjoy the movie, so, you know, good on them. I think for me, like, obviously visually interesting movie, I do sort of wonder if this movie's fallen into sort of the trap of, you know, it's earlier, there's not much else out, but also like the big studio animation especially, but like kids movies more broadly, either don't exist or have shifted to like Netflix and become like these just cheesy roll them off the production line kind of thing. And that to get a movie, like, even if I don't think this movie worked in a lot of ways, and we can get into that in a minute, I think it is thoughtfully made and like well crafted. And so I guess I do wonder, because I think right now on Letterboxd, it's like 125th all time on Letterboxd, which is insane
pretty high
to me. But I do just kind of wonder if it's one of those things where like really, really good studio animation, like broad, wide audience animation that like is actually good, doesn't come along very often. So when we get something like that, people tend to really fawn over it. And that's kind of because, again, this is a movie I thought was fine. Like, I thought it was a pretty good kids movie, but not like, I didn't, it's not, you know, Spider-Verse level. I didn't think you kind of compared it to Pinocchio, or maybe we did in a conversation off air. I don't think this is anywhere approaching like the level of what Pinocchio, Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio, I should point out, brings to the table.
Wait, even not in, Robert Zemeckis?
No, Robert Zemeckis tried his best, okay?
Did he try his best?
The sad part is I think he did. But yeah, I think Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio travels some of the same sort of ideas, and both movies feature Pinocchio. So I think it's just such a more successful movie and a more thorough interrogation of the ideas of death and life and what it means to have that sort of immortality and what it means to give it up and that kind of thing, I think is more intricately explored in Pinocchio. But again, like, this is not a movie that gets released in theaters very often, so I wonder if that's part of it.
Yeah, I can kind of see that effect. I think some of the best animation movies that we've seen in the last couple of years, especially with, you know, with the pandemic, didn't get theatrical releases. You know, of course, like Turning Red went straight to streaming,
right? Instead we got Lightyear,
Wolfwalkers straight to streaming. So they're those are probably a bit underseen. And yeah, this is one that does belong to a bigger studio, has probably a bigger draw, and then of course does get that theatrical release. So there might be a little bit of like a drought effect here that's happening, but well deserved, I would say. I have nothing but praise for this movie. I do think that Spider-Verse's influence on animation in general is very, very present here. Mm-hmm. Even from the opening act, and it's not shot the same way that Spider-Verse is the entire time, but the action scenes are. And so I think that, you know, I don't think it uses that style to the same effect and strength that Spider-Verse does, but it's fine. I do think that the story here, though, something like Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio is feels more in conversation with adults than with children to me. Mm-hmm. It's just a, while visually stunning and, you know, a good movie, feels less entertaining to me from probably a child's perspective. And this, I think, The Last Wish, at least, is more in conversation with a younger audience.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot more, you know, humor. There's a lot more action. And I think that the themes it's exploring and the lessons it's trying to impart on its younger audience are commendable and really, really well executed, in my opinion.
Yeah, I would agree with I think at least most of that. I would say that this movie is definitely aiming for a younger audience, and I think one of the ways that's pretty apparent is it's very, I felt overstuffed. There's a lot of characters and a lot of conflicting motivations, and most of them do get sorted out in a pretty satisfying way. But like the core of this movie, what's good about this movie, one of the things I really liked to begin with is, like you said, the beginning of this movie is sort of about Puss in Boots, and he's this legendary hero and basking in the glory of his own, you know, history and his own legend. And he's forced to confront with death in that first moment. And for the first time in his life, he's scared. And I think when he goes off to the, you could call it sort of the retirement home for cats, but it's just really, it's some woman who loves cats and has just a bunch of them. And he goes and hides out there. And it feels almost like this is going to be a story about somebody who is forced to retire from like a job that they love, or from, you know, like maybe it's an athlete forced to retire from like playing or something like that, you know, where their life's purpose is not what they can do anymore, and forced to like sort of reckon with that and have to deal with like what's left of their existence. And then it becomes sort of like this heist movie where everybody's sort of fighting over this mystical star that grants wishes and all of that. And when it's him toying with death, dealing with a past love, and this sort of hopelessly endearing dog that he meets along the way as well, I think that core story is pretty strong. But then you have Goldilocks and the Three Bears, who have their own sort of journey that they're on, which, you know, shout out Florence Pugh, also had quite a year last year playing Goldilocks. But then also you have John Mulaney's character, Jack Horner or something like that, which is just the you know, oldest Shrek trope, where like the, you know, the fairy tale creature that has like the worst story that nobody likes becomes a villain because nobody likes them from their story, their fairy tale. And it's just like, it's been done a billion times. And his character not only felt really unnecessary to me, but also was just like obnoxious, if not boring at other moments.
Yeah.
You know?
I can see that as, you know, like a, you know, a criticism, I suppose, or feels more like a nitpick to me. I think you have to consider this as like, this is using classic fairy tale characters is like a modern fairy tale, right?
Right.
So you have your central character of Puss in Boots, and the lesson that he ultimately needs to learn is to value the life that he has, and that he wasn't really risking anything when he had all of his 9 lives, but now that he's down to 1, that what he does with this life is truly what will make him, you know, Puss in Boots, so to speak.
Sure.
In the same vein, what you can reduce that lesson to, you should be valuing what you have in front of you. And I think that's pretty reoccurring here, that they kind of, you know, put a hat on it in a few different ways, but that's really what everybody learns, right? That's what Puss in Boots learns, is that what he has right in front of him has value. That's what Kitty Softpaws learns as well, is that there was always someone there that she could trust if she just like opened her heart in the right way.
Right.
And then you have Florence Pugh, who is playing Goldilocks, who in the story is, you know, gets lost in the woods and comes upon this house. But in this version, has been adopted by the bears and doesn't really feel like a member of the family, even though they've treated her like one her whole life. And she learns to appreciate that she does have a family, because that would have been her wishes for a quote unquote real family. So all of these characters learn that what they really needed all along was right in front of them.
Sure.
Right. And then of course you have Jack Horner, voiced by John Mulaney, and a clear Donald Trump parody in this one.
Yeah.
Which is definitely a bit tired, you know, yeah. I would say.
It doesn't have the same effect now that, you know, he's just sort of sad and, you know, truth posting or retruthing through it.
But still very much a Jack Horner character, like,
sure,
in real life. But so, yeah, I mean, that's clearly what they're going for here, even in a likeness a little bit, certainly in disposition. And I think, again, that is a character, a parody character we've seen done to death at this point.
Yeah.
There are still some jokes revolving around that made me laugh. But in a fairy tale, you also need that character. You need something that shows what happens if you don't learn the lesson, and what will become of you. And so that's the role he's filling here. And I think that's enough. Like, it, you know.
Yeah. So where I'm coming from, though, is I think that all makes sense, right? Like, all of these characters do have to come to this realization, and most of them do. One of them doesn't. Sure. Won't even get into the Jiminy Cricket character doing a bad Jimmy Stewart impression. that was just, it made me grind my teeth every time he came on. But I think the thing is, like you said, this is geared for a younger audience, and I understand reinforcing the point. But kids are a lot smarter than I think adults give them credit for when they're making films. Like, just look at some of the dreck that gets made for kids. And I think it's just an example of like either studios pumping stuff out too fast or creators just, you know, not trusting that a kid's going to get the message of like value what you have. And I think there's enough of that in the central story that all of these other characters coming around into it really just detract from what the like what is actually engaging and fun and moving about this movie. And that's sort of where I pull back on the idea that like, okay, all of these things circle back into the same idea. Of course they do, but I don't think it's necessary. And I feel like it gets maybe even a little bit cloying when you get to some of the stuff at the end.
Yeah. Again, I mean, that's something that I don't necessarily fault you for disliking about this. I think that it's actually a pretty smart, I suppose, like, a pretty clever act by the writers, right? It fulfills a couple of needs to have mm-hmm. Jack Horner there. One, you have your villain. You have sort of the catalyst of how all these characters come together because he's the one who's acquiring the map to the actual location of the Last Wish. And then he's also what's kind of he's the one that is like the display of like what happens if you don't learn this lesson,
sure.
Like what you can become and how sort of the wrong way to approach everything. And even just getting to the Last Wish, right? Like he is hoarding all the magic already. His wish is going to be to absorb all the magic that exists in the world. He does the opposite of he's like the opposite of Perito, the dog who's
sure.
Just this sort of the good character. He's nearly flawless, and everything that he's teaching, Puss in Boots and Kitty Softpaws about how to appreciate what's in front of them, Jack Horner is going directly against at every time. The other thing too is Jack Horner is not really on screen unless our other characters are on screen, right?
Yeah.
I think we get one montage of him throwing a bunch of magical items into a magical bag because they've just robbed him of that map.
Sure.
But the rest of the time, the only time he shows up is at like the most inconvenient moment to sort of drive the plot forward. So I think,
yeah, that's fair.
All that said, it I didn't dislike it as much as maybe you did.
So yeah. Let's talk about the most important, things. And this is going to get into some spoiler territory, I guess, that it seems like the writers of this movie understood what was necessary to get out of Puss in Boots 2 10 years later. So
this is 3, no?
No, it's just 2, just the second one. The way this movie ends, let's give a little spoiler here. It ends with Puss in Boots and Kitty Softpaws and Perito sailing off to far, far away, seemingly in search of Shrek. Is that the read that you got from the end of this movie that they're going?
Oh,
to
yeah,
be
it's extremely
bringing
clear.
Shrek into a Puss in Boots 3 and possibly yeah. Rebooting the Shrek franchise.
Yeah, I mean, we may even, not to get all, speculative YouTuber here, but I think we may even have a Puss in Boots appearance in Shrek 5, which will then lead into Puss in Boots 3.
Yeah.
And then, maybe Pinocchio will get a spinoff. We're looking at a Shrek cinematic universe on the horizon.
God, I think this movie is creative and interesting in a lot of ways, and to have it serve as sort of the introduction or reintroduction of Shrek is, say the least, concerning to me. Like, I think Shrek is a franchise that obviously a lot of people have a lot of nostalgia for, but something that ran its course, I'm not going to come in here and sort of besmirch the quality of the first couple Shrek movies, because those are movies that I liked a lot growing up. But, by the time they got to like Shrek Forever After and all the, like holiday specials and side projects and Puss in Boots spinoff, like it really seemed like this was a franchise that had kind of run its course. So I'm a little nervous.
You know what's crazy is I actually went, so walking out of the theater, right? And I was talking to my friend about this. Sort of a similar conversation about what's next and like I thought, again, like, this was Puss in Boots 3, not Puss in Boots 2. And talking about them going to Far, Far Away. He told me, he was like, well, the last Shrek was like 12 years ago or something, right? And I was like, no way. Like, that sounds...
Shrek so... 4 was that long ago?
Yeah, I think Shrek 4 was 2010 or 2011. Like, it is fairly old. And I was like,
2010, dang. Yeah, wow.
That's why, yeah, exactly. That I was had the exact same reaction. I was a bit stunned. I was like, no way. It feels like much larger and closer than it actually is. So it's been a while. Shrek 5 is on the horizon. But to Puss in Boots, you know, The Last Wish's credit, as a standalone film, this completely works. There's some cameos in there from, you know, the Shrek franchise that we get. We get like Pinocchio. There, one of Puss's, like flashbacks to his earlier lives shows him walking with Shrek and Donkey.
Anna pointed out that like there was a witch from like Shrek 3 or something in the waiting room of the doctor's office.
Oh, yeah. I didn't recognize her, but that does make sense. And then at the end, of course, they're sailing to Far, Far Away. But if you've never seen any of the Shreks, and you're just watching this movie,
Seen Puss in Boots, it still works.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, so as far as retooling a franchise goes, this is a good way to start it off. With that, why don't we round it up ourselves here? What are you giving this one?
I give it a solid 4.
Wow, that's pretty high. I think this is another movie, much like Megan. Maybe the only way it is like Megan is that I also gave it 3 stars. I had fun with this one too, kind of again, like I did with Megan. It was a good time, an entertaining movie. But again, I just think that like as far as these things go, maybe I'll go back to that first point. I think we can get a little over our skis sometimes when we see like a good kids movie. And again, I think this is a good movie, but I don't think it's like great to the degree that some of like the best animation that we see in any given year might be.
Yeah. I can kind of agree to that tendency of overrating a children's film. Cause you're like, oh, this is just supposed to be for kids. And then it's, you know, competent and it feels like it's incredible. I'm kind of in the middle on that. Like it's much more than competent. I think it's really mm-hmm. good. Not quite incredible, but it's something that I really enjoyed and would love to come back to. I can't overstate how much I love this iteration of Death. I think he's so cool. He's presented as this sort of bounty hunter at first, someone who's just, you know, trying to capture Puss in Boots for like a monetary reward. But then you come to find out that he's actually Death, which I mean is fairly telegraphed as well. But
right,
conversation...
I'm surprised they even tried to hide it at first. Yeah. You know.
The conversations that they have, the way that he taunts Puss in Boots and, you know, chastises him for
sort of ominous whistle
being a little arrogant dick. And then, yeah, his whistle, excellent. Just
it's a good character. 10
Death.
10 out of 10. All right, Zach, we are going to close things off here. A return from a short break since our Top 10s episode. We mentioned Letterboxd. That's going to be the best way to follow us as we do Sundance this year. So why don't you throw out where people can find you?
I'm at painted_dog on Letterboxd.
Awesome. And I'm at EvanD26. That's going to be the best way to follow us there. You can follow our website. It's spinningthereel.com. I've just posted in this last week the written top 10 list. So if you want some more context on our episode from a couple weeks ago, that will be there. We will be back hopefully next week to talk about something. A Man Called Otto missing. There's some options that we're going to have, Zach. Anything in particular you want to throw out there right away? People should be ready for?
No, not that I can think of at the moment, actually. Okay.
Well, whatever it is, we hope that Cody will be there with us. We miss you, Cody, as always. Bye.